January 1st meeting of the Senate Committee on Finance and Revenue. Some housekeeping issues today. We have a new member, and we have some adoption of rules and some bill introductions. Then we want to discuss some of the things that are going to come up this session, some things we hope will come up this session. Before we do that, I'd like to introduce our members and have maybe the members introduce themselves. And we'll just start off and say hello. Tell us who you are, where you represent, and what you did on New Year's Eve this last year. And let's start with our newest member. It's been a while since...
Chris, you look different.
It's been a while since this unit has had a female, and so forgive us in advance for the little male things that we do. Welcome.
I didn't know it all.
Senator Taylor.
Thank you, Senator Hass. If I didn't already know you, I would be offended. But since I know you and I know you didn't mean anything by that, I will just go ahead and proceed. So hello, everyone. I'm Senator Taylor. I represent Senate District 21, which is Southeast Portland, Milwaukee, and Oak Grove. And I'm very excited to be here today. I'll be serving on the Revenue Committee. I'll be chairing the Workforce Committee, serving on the Statewide Transportation Committee, and Natural Resources Ways and Means Sub. And what I did on New Year's Eve is I was in Bend, and we were skiing.
Terrific. Senator Boquist.
I should have been skiing. I'm Senator Boquist, and I will offend the new senator. I'm formerly of the all-white male old man's committee, which is what they used to call us, right? And now we have, you know, talent to my left versus us. I represent Senate District 12, which is the rural portion of the western part of the Willamette Valley. And I'm just peachy keen to be here.
Senator Riley.
Yeah, I'm Chuck Riley. I'm Senate District 15, Hillsborough, Corningus, Forest Grove, North Plains, Roy, Verbort, and some farms. And I'm on not only on the Revenue Committee, I'm also on, as all of us are, I think, the Tax Credits Committee. I'm on the Audits Committee. I'm on the Business and Transportation Committee. I'm on the Joint IT Committee. And I chair the Government Accountability Committee.
Senator Bertschinger.
Herman Bertschinger, representing Southern Oregon, Josephine County, the northern half of Jackson County. And on New Year's Eve, I celebrated with the New Yorkers via television and was in bed shortly after 9 Pacific time.
That's life in the fast lane.
Yeah. So
Senator Riley.
I forgot my New Year's Eve. I was with friends at the coast. We had a party down there and with some very pleasant folks, and most of us were in bed like at 12:15. Mm-hmm. Everybody went home and went to bed. So and by the way, you're right about talent on your left, Senator.
Well, I could also say youth, too, because at New Year's Eve, I was the youngest person at the party.
So. Oh, okay. Wow.
At 12:05, I think everybody was in bed.
Uh-huh.
Mark Hass from the Beaverton area of Washington County on New Year's Eve. We were at Timberline with our family, and we also did some skiing and had a great time and highly recommend it. So welcome, everybody. We do need to, us four need to raise our standards from last session, thanks to Senator Taylor. Let's start out. Some of you've all read the rules, I hope. They haven't changed, and we need to adopt them as our first order of business.
Mr. Chair, I move the Senate Committee on Finance and Revenue adopt the 2017 session rules.
Senator Boquist moves adoption of the committee rules. Discussion? Objection? Seeing none, the rules are adopted. We have a couple of committee bills to introduce here today. Senator Boquist, I don't know if you had a chance to read them or if you want to.
Mr. Chair, I move that LC 3366 dated 1/25/17 and LC 3774 dated 1/26/17 be introduced as committee bills, and I'll speak to the motion.
Senator Boquist moves that committee bills LC 3366 and LC 3774 be introduced as committee bill. Senator Boquist.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As normal, committee bills are simply bills brought forward by various staff members and for the committee to consider in the future, and anyone's vote does not reflect support or opposition to that LC. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Further discussion? Seeing none. Objections? Seeing none. Those LCs are adopted. Well, we're really privileged again this session to be under the tutelage and, of our the legendary Dr. Paul Warner. And I really honestly, truthfully don't know how this revenue committee could function without your mentorship and ability. So thank you for being here. Much of the rest of this meeting will be facilitated by you. So why don't you give us an overview of
I have to say for the committee, Mr. Chair, today is my 18th anniversary of working for the legislature.
Wow.
So I think that qualifies me for dinosaur status.
My condolences.
Happy anniversary. I think this is the paper anniversary, 18th.
That's right. Yeah. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, committee members, and welcome back. As usual, we've got a whole series of issues for you to work on this session. Our plan today is I'm going to walk through some very high level, just some things that we've talked about in the past, you've identified during the interim and discussions with the chair that we expect will be issues you'll be addressing. And then we wanted to spend some time going through our public finance basic facts document. You've got your committee staff over here, a group of economists that are specialized in each of these areas, and they're going to briefly go through those with you and so answer any questions that you have in some of those areas. And we anticipate a number of bills and issues in each of those areas in this session. But the other thing I wanted to point out that we have, you have the basic facts document, and you also have, courtesy Department of Revenue, they just released their Oregon corporate income tax, this colorful document, which is excellent document. It goes through the recent data on corporate income taxes, on the corporate minimum tax, and you can see by industry, by size, and so forth. It's a good background material. Well, let me go ahead and go through the issues real quickly with you that we have outlined. On you can see those in OLIS under 2017 key issues. The first one we have listed there is corporate apportionment issues, and this is an area that we've kind of danced around, I think, as both the House and Senate Revenue Committees over the last several sessions. They came up as a number of issues that I think you're going to be dealing with were important in consideration of Measure 97, which would have had a very large increase in the corporate minimum tax, and really brought up this idea of what do we mean by Oregon sales. And there are some very nuanced areas involved. The one I think that was discussed the most was around the method in which intangibles are apportioned. And that's the we use the in our statutes, direct the Department of Revenue use the cost of performance approach, which is completely different than how you apportion tangible property. The cost of performance approach means, in effect, that a taxpayer, a company that is produces services and sells them to customers outside the state, is essentially still counted as an Oregon sale because it's where that service is performed. So we have a bill to address that very early on. In fact, on Monday we have a bill that looks at that. We also have also included in that bill an issue that has come up periodically is around the throwback rule under the current apportionment formula. If you are selling your product, tangible product, into a state that you do not have nexus in, that cannot tax you, it's not whether they don't tax you, but they cannot tax you because of nexus standards, those sales are thrown back to Oregon. So even though they're not technically in Oregon, they're thrown back to the state under our apportionment formula. So that's another issue that may come up in terms of addressing the apportionment issues. Another one that we'll have a report later in the session and still trying to get some information on is a change that you made for the broadcasters and how they're apportioned. And we've Chris has been working closely with the department on that to try to determine how much information we have. So that's another issue that may come before you during the session related to apportionment. The second area we have listed, you had received some testimony on this issue regarding the active pass-through income, which was a part of the 2013 special session, where you established a lower tax rate for this type of income, as long as there's material participation, that taxpayers had an election to use this lower rate if they met the qualifications. So we have a couple of bills in committee that look at a couple of issues. One is in terms of the employment criteria and what employment criteria are used to be eligible. And the second one is an issue that's come up in the interim from tax preparers who had taxpayers who did not file for the election on April 15th. And the current statute says that they made an irrevocable decision, meaning that they cannot go back and amend those returns. So we've gotten I'm sure you've probably heard from some of these folks. And so that's another bill out there for you to consider. The third one is the biennial favorite around tax credit sunsets. You have a group of tax credit sunsets that would cost you roughly $32 million to extend. Those are not, by the way, in the current law forecast, so they would have to be accommodated in the budget. One of the statutory requirements we have is to provide you with a detailed report on each of those sunsetting credits, do some analysis on those. Chris has done a lot of work on that in the interim, so he's going to be going through that with you next week. He's putting the finishing touches on that report. So detailed analysis. We've got some of the credits, for example, a research and development credit is scheduled to sunset, which has been around a long time. A lot of what we call the children of Betsy, which are the smaller energy-related credits, are coming due. And then, of course, another biennial favorite, the rural medical care health credit will be sunsetting.
Are you bringing Tums for that one?
Yes, that's right. Yes, yes. The next issue is we've had a series of discussions in the past around tobacco and e-cigarettes, vaping, these issues. A direct rate increase, which we do have in committee, but would not be a bill that could originate in the Senate, is something that we've looked at in the past. A number of states have begun to include vaping products as part of their tax base. So we've done some research into that. Christine has done a lot of research on what other states have done. And we had a cigarette tax increase proposed in the governor's budget. And we've seen some increases, particularly in California, that may affect the environment. So that's an issue we would anticipate. The next one is around tax havens, we have one of the things that was part of the 2013 legislation that established these what we call listed jurisdictions that meet certain criteria was for the Department of Revenue to review that criteria, make recommendations to the committee on which jurisdictions should be included or excluded from the current list. And they have prepared that report, and they'll be ready to go through that with you on Monday. So they'll walk through what their latest report is. We have that available on our website now, and that will be a discussion to have. By the way, I did want to mention that tomorrow we have the new director of Department of Revenue, Neil Ray, will be here to go do an overview of the department with you. The next issue I have listed is on nonprofit property tax exemptions. We've had a work group. Senator Riley was on the work group. Senator Boquist was on the work group. And to go through and look at the statutes, we've had concerns from the assessors in particular about getting a clearer direction about what constitutes a nonprofit for property tax purposes. You do have a bill that was a committee bill that has basically a reporting requirement that requires those that get the exemption to file a form with their local assessor so there's an consistent set of data. So it's also, of course, potentially a much broader issue in terms of what the property tax base is. And the last two are the biggest in terms of impact. Both would have a major restructuring effect on the tax system. We have been doing a lot of work with Senator Haas and with others around business tax reform. And we have looking at a way to approach business taxation. Again, it's something that came up in Measure 97. Was one of kind of the underlying issues is how do we tax business? What's the appropriate way to do that? What are the kind of things you think about at the state level? So what I thought I would do is tomorrow, we have time after the director's presentation to walk through an article with you that I think is a very, lays out very good from a tax review panel in Connecticut, but it has some of the top economists looking at the alternative ways to tax business and doing kind of a pros and cons, and I'll walk through that with you as kind of part of my orientation time. So then the last issue is another perennial favorite around property tax reform. We've been working some with the League of Oregon Cities, has been trying to put together a work group and put together some pieces. Right now we just have a placeholder bill, or actually a resolution for the committee, and trying to build on the work that you did last session around what are the components of the property tax system that make the most sense. And so we'll plan to continue that effort in this session.
And we have committee bills with placeholder language for, I think, all of that, right, with the exception of the tax credit.
Yes, Mr. Chair, the tax credits, you have a number of the sunset extensions in the committee. Then some others have gone to policy committees, and then you have all of those have a subsequent referral to the Joint Tax Credit Committee, which we assume will start to do their work later in the session, probably near the end of the session. So we have draft requests out that we should have to you as for committee bill introduction around business tax reform. One would be looking at it, because this is a Senate committee, would be looking at it as a constitutional amendment. What kind of components would you put in the Constitution for a new tax? So those should be ready for you by next week for introduction.
Okay. Questions on the session overview? Okay, those are pretty meaty chapters there.
Mm-hmm. And Mr. Chair, I think we have relating clauses for the sky.
For the what?
For the entire sky. So we can probably do anything.
Okay.
So what I would like to do, Mr. Chair, is start working through the basic facts document. And start with Christine and Chris to come up and walk through the income tax and the corporate income tax pieces. The first section of the document itself is a section that I write around the basic facts. It uses the census data and shows how we compare with other states, and it really highlights the differences. But those are things that you're all very familiar with: reliance on the income tax, no consumption tax, and it goes through and shows those comparisons. So I thought we would start right away into the major taxes, and Christine with the personal income tax.
Christine.
Okay. Chair Haas, members of the committee, for the record, Christine Broniak with the Legislative Revenue Office. Today I'm going to go through several sections of the basic facts document, including the section on the Oregon personal income tax. There's some summary information here at the beginning of the document, but you can see the section on personal income taxes starting at C1. And so I was able to just do a description of the Oregon tax rates. These range from 5 to 9.9% of taxable income, and that's taxable income is adjusted gross income plus Oregon additions less Oregon subtractions and deductions. So it's connected to the federally adjusted gross income. The Rate schedule for the 2017 tax year is given here on page C1, and basically the brackets are indexed to inflation, with the exception of some of the upper brackets of $125,000 or above. And so there's just a little bit here about the history of the 2013 special session. Also, in 2014, all personal income tax returns reported a total of adjusted gross income of $111.1 billion, and the average adjusted gross income for all returns was $57,165. That's an increase of 6.1% from 2013 values. Oregon taxpayers had a total tax liability of $6.6 billion. That's an increase of 12% from 2013. The average Oregon tax liability for full-year filers was $3,637, and that's up 9.1% from 2013. And so there's some amounts here for the standard deductions for various types of returns, and that is all indexed to inflation. Can see here the personal income tax collections. This is the largest sort of state tax source of state tax revenue. And for the 17-19 biennium, they're projected to comprise 89% of the total general fund revenues. And that's a little bit up from 15-17, when they were 87% of the total general fund revenues. Here, there's a kind of a long history of various types of tax and tax reform measures that have happened. I will just zoom us forward to 2016. And in that year, the last session, the federal conformity was updated to December 31st, 2015. So income that was federally taxable was also taxed by Oregon, with some exceptions. They increased the earned income tax credit from 8% to 11% of federal credit, only for taxpayers with a dependent under the age of 3. They increased the annual program cap on the film and video tax credit from $10 million to $12 million in 2016 and to $14 million in 2017. The biomass manure tax credit was extended through January 1st, 2022, but the rate was reduced from $5 per wet ton to $3.50 per wet ton. Here we have the number of returns. In 2014, the total number of full-year returns was about 1.7 million. And it was up 2.6% from the previous year. And see, the number of returns can move cyclically. You can see it was down during the recession and then recovered somewhat. The figure of 2.6% looks to be a little bit over the population growth. So it's reflective of more people having jobs and economic recovery. Here's just a kind of a pie chart that describes the Oregon tax returns and the tax liability. Most of the tax returns are from full-year filers. That's 87%. And then part-year and non-resident filers together make up 13%. Full-year filers have even more of a percentage of the liability relative to part-year and non-resident filers. So there's a number of components of income that can be seen here: wages, dividends, business income, net capital gains, retirement, and other income. And so this just tracks along mostly with the economy. The capital gains increased about 50% from 2013 to 2014. So that's the most sort of cyclical type of income, and wages have increased. This is simply a table that describes the different types of properties of people's tax returns, and it splits it out by adjusted gross income. So you can see there the total amounts of various types of tax statistics here by income. And the next, on page C11, the table shows the average income and tax. So this is the averages for people of various income categories, as opposed to the total for statewide. There, finally, is a table on page C12 that shows the various sources of income. And this is simply for full-year returns, so people who are in the state for the entire year. It shows how much of their income comes from various categories. And so there's basically totals for statewide amounts here on the table on page C12. And with that, we come to corporate income taxes, and Chris
Christina,
will talk about that.
Not so fast. On the bottom of the full year returns, the total, those joint returns. So if I see wages, salaries, and tips, that total says, you know, what am I looking at? Are those joints or what?
Chair Haas, the full year returns would include both all types of filers, so single, joint, head of household, etc. So that would be everybody's who was a full year filer.
So what can we discern from this from the income tax most recent year compared to the previous? Is there any takeaway?
Overall, the tables that compare the 2014 numbers to 2013 numbers are a bit more informative about that. You can see that there's been a bit of a economic recovery, and that people's wages are recovering, as well as even the number of people who file taxes. And that could be more from the tables that compare things. If you look at components of income, so page C9, you can see that the wages have gone from 64 million to 68.611 million dollars in the state, and so that's indicative of a bit of a recovery there. Also, the capital gains have increased quite a bit, because that's the most highly cyclical type of income category.
Question. Senator Bertschinger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So just a general overall statement. Would we say revenue, the trend is moving up? Would that be a good statement?
Chair Haas, Senator Bertschinger, yes, I could say that.
Thank
as
you.
Long as it lasts.
Question, Mr. Chair.
Senator Boquist.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Christine, I think you said correctly, if I'm right here, that gross return was about 2.6%.
In returns, right. Chair Haas and Senator Boquist, that's correct. The returns have grown a little bit more than the population growth.
Follow up. Could you define, if it's 2.6% of return growth, what is the population growth? I'm looking for the differential between population growth and return growth.
Would
you get that?
I can definitely confirm that. It's 2.1%. It's around 2.2% typically when I project population growth, but I can get you a more specific number, official number.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
So if it's a 0.4, is an actual... What I'm trying to discern is that how much of between population growth return, and then what is the percentage of that is actually wage growth
and specifically, and I know you don't have the answer right now, but specifically, how many of the jobs that did we create are actually second jobs? Because, well, let's say hypothetically, we created X amount of jobs in Oregon in the past year. Were those jobs actually taken up by new employment, i.e. reducing then the or increasing, whatever you want to call it, the percentage of the population in the workforce? Or is that simply people taking a second job, and that job created is simply why we don't have such a larger growth on our rate of on our returns?
Well, Chair Hess, Senator Boquist, these numbers would be indicative of someone who had most likely no job if they were not filing a return at all, mm-hmm. to someone who now has a job of some sort that they're actually filing a return again. There's not an additional return for another job. A person just has their return if they've had any income that's of a sufficient amount.
Well, Mr. Chair, exactly my point is that they're still filing a return. Mm-hmm. Yeah, if you take the population growth away from it, that gives you a delta. Then the question comes back of how many new jobs that we created in Oregon are actually in population growth, in that 0.4% growth, or are those new jobs really part-time jobs or jobs that someone that was currently employed filing a return? Because based on revenue growth, you would assume on the blanket that we have a fairly substantial wage increase and wage growth increase. However, those numbers isolated don't show that. And so the real analytical question is, you know, how many people with new jobs, because we're going to talk about job creation here in several bills coming forward, and, you know, you only get a tax break or this if you create so many jobs. The question is, what are those jobs that are being created, and are they actually people already in the workforce taking a second job, which, of course, then is a poverty issue because they can't survive on the first job. And that's a little bit more in-depth, but I think Dr. Warner grasps where I'm going here as we have these further discussions down there, and it would be appreciated if we did a little more analysis on that.
Chair, Senator Boquist, one thing to keep in mind about the numbers that Christine is going through are 2014, so we were at an earlier stage in the expansion. So I think that there was a substantial decrease in the unemployment rate during that period. So you did have people coming back into the labor force and working, whereas I think now we're in a different situation where I think you're going to see more of the part-time jobs being more of a factor with any additional job growth we get. So because this was, you know, a different phase of the cycle than we're in now.
And, of course, Dr. Warner, the challenge is that we don't know where we are in the cycle. The cycle is likely to change, as you and I have discussed before. Yes. And as a good example, is just, you know, we see Intel over the last, you know, short amount of period thought they were going to cut 12,000 jobs and cut 15,000 jobs. And so we can see a downward trend on the corporate side of job creation.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Worth noting, though, speaking of Intel, that last week Washington County released the metro area unemployment rates, and Washington County is at 3.8% unemployment, which a lot of economists will tell you is probably full employment. So, but anyway, I think it's worthy to spend some time poring over these numbers on the income tax that is the big revenue driver for this state, so much that it's become a long-time problem because of our reliance on it. And so I think it's good to get this booklet and just look at it and read it and conjure it, and because it is the long-time problem, our reliance on this tax. Sorry to go off on that tangent. Go ahead.
The Swiss Alps, Mr. Chair.
The Swiss Alps.
Of Oregon.
That's all I have. If there's no more questions, I can hand it over to Chris.
Okay.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Chris Allenack, Legislative Revenue Office. So I'm going to go through a few pages on the corporate income excise tax. And the goal here is just to introduce a few concepts and a few basic numbers. A lot of the information related to corporate income tax is not intuitive, and it takes a lot of time hearing concepts repeated a few times before they start to sink in. So I just want to touch on some of those just as an initial round for you, that you have a lot of technical bills related to the corporate excise tax this session. So the basics are we have a two-bracket rate structure for corporate income tax, and it's technically the excise tax. There's a 6.6 rate and a 7.6% rate. Income up to $1 million is taxed at 6.6, and taxable income above that is 7.6. We also have a 12-tiered corporate minimum tax, which ranges from $150 for corporations whose Oregon sales are less than $500,000 up to $100,000 minimum tax for corporations whose Oregon sales are $100 million or more. One footnote about the minimum tax is how it interacts with corporate tax credits. There was a court case that determined that the corporate minimum, that credits could be used to reduce the corporate minimum tax. And so for tax years 2009 through 2014, that was the case. In 2015, the legislature changed that for tax years 2015 through 2020 and disallowed credits against the minimum tax. The revenue impact of that, roughly speaking, is $5 to $6 million a year. So that's just an outstanding issue to keep back in mind, depending on which year we're talking about, credits may or may not be allowed against the minimum tax. For context with the general fund revenue, as the graph shows, for the past couple of years, most recent fiscal years, corporate tax collections have been around $600 million. The forecast right now actually has that coming down, edging down to about $500 million a year. And historically, that puts us at about 5 to 6% of the general fund revenue that comes from corporate taxes, just some context numbers. And on the next page, there's a table for apportionment formula. So the concept here is you have corporations that operate in multiple states, and Oregon gets to tax some of their income. On the easiest side, you can have a C corporation that exists in Oregon and only operates in Oregon, and then the state taxes 100% of their income because all of their activities are within the state. For corporations that may operate in all 50 states, the question is, how much of that income can be taxed by Oregon? And that's this issue of apportionment. And there are different ways to apportion, but the way Oregon has done it for several years is what's referred to as the single sales factor. So for our starting point, the income that is under question is federal taxable income. Our tax system, as you'll hear more about, the tax system is tied to federal law. So the starting point for corporations is federal taxable income. So Oregon looks at that, and the question is, how much of that can be taxed by Oregon? Well, we tax a percentage of that, and that percentage is Oregon sales divided by national sales. And oftentimes, these percentages can be very small. For the largest corporations, they're going to be a tenth of a percent or smaller. But it can be 1%, 10%. But that, the whole idea of apportionment is really how much Oregon can tax. Now, one thing, as I was preparing for this, I realized I should probably add a glossary to this document. So there are a few terms that I want to throw out just to introduce them to you. You're going to hear more about them as we go through some bills. One concept is a unitary business, and the idea here is corporations can be very complicated. Some of them can be very simple, where it's a single entity, and it may not be very big, but the largest corporations can be very complicated, and they can own other corporations, and they can own other entities. So the key term here is unitary business, and the idea there is if you have a group of companies that where there is cross-ownership, a lot of vertical integration, some common management practices, the concept is that they are all effectively one economic unit, even though they may be legally different businesses. It's a unitary business, and then they can be taxed as a single entity. Another key term is a consolidated tax return, and that's how Oregon corporations file, and that's basically one tax return representing all of these disparate different businesses because they are one economic unit. In comparison, some states have a separate filing requirement where each corporation files its own separate tax return. Another key term is nexus, and I think Paul mentioned this, and this is just the ability and the legal ability for a state to tax a corporation. If a corporation isn't doing business in Oregon, then we can't tax. Then the state can't tax them. It just prevents Oregon from reaching out and taxing a corporation that only operates in say, Nebraska or some other state. There has to be some connection to the state. And then the last thing is apportionment can be broken down. So what I described is for all corporations. The next tier there is the type of business that the corporation does. And we break that up into tangible products and intangibles or services. Tangible products get apportioned kind of a little more intuitively on a proportional market-based concept. If a business sells desks or chairs in the state and they arrive here, then that's the Oregon tax is their market share. For services and intangibles, it's called cost of performance, which is an all-or-nothing situation where it's the apportionment isn't by where those sales occur, it's where the cost to produce those sales or intangibles occurs, and the state that has the plurality of that cost gets all of those sales. So it's an all-or-nothing situation.
And so that's the bill that we're going to look at to try to make that consistent.
Correct, Chair. That this issue has been around a long time, and a lot of states have moved from the cost of performance to market. It's been around going back several decades when services were not a large share of the economy, so it wasn't a major issue. But over time, as everybody, as the committee is aware, the economy is much more reliant on services, so it's getting to be more of an issue. So that, coupled with states moving towards single sales, which is a market concept, those two policies are at odds. And so the question is laid before the committee and the legislature about which way to go.
Could you give us a hypothetical of a tangible company and a service company and how their tax bill would be affected?
So a tangible company, if I own a corporation and I sell chairs and I operate in on the West Coast, California, Oregon, and Washington, and I'm headquartered in Oregon, and 20% of my sales go to Washington, 50% of my sales go to Oregon, and 30% of my sales go to California, then for Oregon, 50% of my taxable income gets taxed by Oregon, and the 20% goes to Washington, and 30% goes to California. Now, that may be, it gets more complicated because it depends on the tax system of those states, but for Oregon purposes, 50% of my sales would be taxed by Oregon. Now, if I am operating in the same three states and I'm a
software
is a good example, and it doesn't matter where my sales occur, it matters where my cost of performance is. So I could have 50% of my sales in Washington, 50% of my sales in California, all of my offices and production are in Oregon, then all of those sales get attributed to Oregon. And Oregon taxes all of them. It could also go the other way, where say I have offices in Oregon and Washington, and for the cost of performance, 60% of my costs are from my Washington office and 40% are from Oregon, then all of the sales would go to Washington and Oregon can't tax any of it. And so that's very different from the concept of a single sales factor. And taxing a corporation on their benefiting from basically Oregon's economy, which would be measured by sales in Oregon.
And Mr. Chair, just following Chris's example on California, California is a market state. So your software company would be paying 100% apportioned to Oregon and 50% or apportioned to California where their sales are. So they can be more than 100% depending on this combination of states.
Yeah, the theoretical idea behind apportionment is we start with this federal taxable income, and every state taxes its share of that income, and over all of the states that the corporation operates in, 100% exactly of their income gets taxed by the states. But because of that point, it's really all over the map as to whether corporations get taxed on less than 100% or even more than 100%.
And that is why those service businesses were so opposed to 97 because it
it really came up in Measure 67 when the minimum tax went from $10 to $100,000 for large ones. At $10, arguably that you can have that debate, but it's $10, nobody's going to really that's not going to raise any concern. But it went from $10 to $100,000, we heard from some software companies, I believe, who are exactly that. They operated in Oregon. All of their sales were in Idaho or something. And so arguably they shouldn't have been paying the $10 depending on the policy, but they weren't going to worry about that. But when it went from $10 to $100,000, now they're paying $100,000 to Oregon, which is a single sales factor state, and all of their sales in reality go to Idaho. And part of that issue is taking, trying to have corporate taxes based on the market value, if you will, for what the companies earn from a state's economy. And the notion of sales was taken from this apportionment concept, which is perhaps anachronistic from a day when services weren't a significant part of the economy.
Okay, thank you, Senator Burchard.
Chris, back to your share scenario with 50% Oregon, 30 California, and 20 Washington.
Okay.
The taxes they'd pay in Washington and the taxes they'd pay in Oregon, doesn't that reduce their tax liability in Oregon then? Is that a deduction on the Oregon?
The taxes that they pay, all of those, I'm trying to think through this, and I may need to get back to you with a little more detail because it does get complicated.
No, it gets complicated, like you said.
All of the taxes that they pay should be deducted on their federal return. And so it'll be taken out of the federal taxable income. So that should be, again, getting back to that starting point, it's federal taxable income, so it's after all of those taxes that they pay. So I think it'll be embedded in there because there's not an add back. But with a footnote, I'll think about that a little bit more.
But
to
that
see
carries forward to the next year. It doesn't carry for the taxable year that you're dealing with at that time.
Right, so there could be some disparities on an individual year, but over time, I think it should be accounted for, but I'll think about that a little bit more.
Okay.
Senator Bokus.
Just follow up on what you're thinking on that, because there's the second issue, which is, I think, the crux to the issue. Even though it may be deductible on your federal tax, so therefore it's deductible and you're not doing it, you're still double paying, which means the software corporation, in your example, its minimum tax was $100,000, but it's paying $50,000 additional someplace else. Even though it's deductible, they may not have had the $50,000 to even pay the bloody tax. Hence the problem, correct?
Correct.
Okay.
And just one more term out there is the Multi-State Tax Commission. You're going to, well, depending on how things unfold, there are a couple of bills related to the Multi-State Tax Commission and Multi-State Tax Compact. And the intent there is to try and get all 50 states on the same page so that this double taxation or less than 100% isn't an issue. But we have 50 states doing 50 different things, and that just adds to the complexity. And the Oregon legislature has control, obviously, over Oregon policy, not other states. So there's a history here that I'm not going to go through. There haven't been substantial changes to the corporate tax since Measure 67. There was obviously a lot of discussions last fall. But the next, I have a series of charts here, again, just trying to convey very simple contextual numbers for you to have in the back of your mind as you're deliberating policies and chatting with folks. Generally speaking, in recent years, we have 90,000 corporations filing tax returns. That changes a little bit over time, but there are 90,000 corporations. And I'm going to be using round numbers here. 60,000 of them are S corporations, and 30,000 of them are C corporations. Some of the differences between the two, S corporations, they're thought of as smaller corporations, but they aren't always smaller. Some of them can be very sizable in terms of sales. S corporations, a couple of the factors. S corporations can only have up to 100 shareholders, and they can only have one class of stock, as opposed to C corporations, which are, they can be publicly traded, they can have any number of shares and different kinds of stock. The large multinational corporation names that people are familiar with and can be traded, those are the big C corporations. Those won't be S corporations. S corporations, generally, they're not public. So that's the main 90,000 corporations, two-thirds are S corps and one-third C corps. So on the next chart, it's a breakdown by industry, and this is just the number of returns. So we can see, for example, that in the professional, scientific, and technical services, we have a lot of S corporations, and also in the construction industry, we have a lot of S corporations. and the number of C corporations is also fairly large for wholesale trade, and also the professional scientific in terms of their share of C corporations. So that's just a breakdown of the number of corporations. The next chart is a breakdown of tax. And here we say for tax year 2014, $512 million in tax was owed by C corporations, and $10 million was owed by S corporations. The S corporations, for the most part, just pay the $150 minimum tax. They can pay tax above that for some situations where it's kind of a built-in capital gains. If you have a C corp that switches to an S corp, there can be some capital gain in that that gets taxed. But for the most part, it's just that minimum tax. And of the $500 million, again, for 2014 tax paid by C corporations, most of that was the wholesale trade sector. The second largest group was finance and insurance, and then we get down to retail trade. And a lot of these trends really came out in the discussions last fall about how much tax is paid by the retail and wholesale trade.
Senator Burchaker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I think we should point out, and stop me if I'm wrong, Chris, but in a C corporation scenario, a lot of that money goes to the shareholders, and then the shareholders pay personal income tax on whatever dividends or what they get out of their portion. And on the S corps, that just passes through to the individual, who then in return pay on their personal income tax.
Yes, the C corporations will pay dividends, and that'll show up on the personal income tax. The S corporations, all of them, so that's where you can potentially get into this double taxation on the C corporate side. But the C corporations pays tax, they pay dividends, and then individuals who receive those dividends pay personal income tax on that. S corporations, the starting point is if an S corporation has $10 million in taxable income and 10 shareholders, that could be divided equally. It doesn't have to be divided equally. It depends on how the corporation is structured. But all of that income just gets passed through to the personal side. And the last couple of charts I touch on are the business structure, so I will circle back to this.
I just want to make sure that people don't get the impression that corporations don't pay that much tax. They have to realize that those profits move to somebody else who eventually pays the tax.
Roughly speaking, the tax liability that Christine was going over, ballpark figure, 10% of that is paid on business income from pass-through entities. It does change, but I'm just trying to lay some basic numbers that are easy to keep in the back of your mind. About 10% of that is paid by businesses.
Sure. Senator Boquist.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chris, do we have access to data to match the C corporations and S corporations to jobs?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, no, it gets really tricky.
I know.
Okay. On the return, the way I describe it is when the corporation files their tax return, the information that is contained on that return is information that is directly needed to determine taxable income and tax. And the number of jobs or number of employees is not relevant to that. The total amount paid in compensation is, because that's deductible. So we'll have total wages and compensation paid, but we won't have the number of employees, because whether a corporation has 10 employees or 1,000 employees is irrelevant to determining their tax. If we want to go down that path, then it involves the Department of Revenue and the Employment Department trying to match up data, which conceptually should happen, but in my personal experience, we run into a lot of problems.
Given our new computer system and your crystal ball, and the fact that, you know, I think it's 941s. I mean, we do have the federal side does have the data that tells us how many employees someone has and all that, so on and so forth. Do we have in our crystal ball any thought process that DOR will be able to reach in or get that sort of data easier in the future from the IRS? Or are we completely relying on the Employment Department, as you so articulately stated their competency?
I would categorize that as a hope. We continue to work toward that. Mm-hmm. And the only way to get number of employees is through employment data. They'll have the employer, and it's through the withholding program, the unemployment compensation program, other tax or the like programs, mm-hmm. where we could link those and try to get better employment data. We're constantly working with it, and we're hoping any improvements in technology, we're hoping to take advantage of. I can't guarantee that we will, but it is definitely high on our list of hopes to get done.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Wouldn't that information be pretty readily available on the quarterly reports that businesses file? Because you put right on your quarterly report how many employees, you list them all. It should be pretty easy.
The quarterly
report. You don't put the type of structure.
With the SEC, you mean the federal? Or
no,
you mean
the Oregon quarter. You put your employees in.
I think that's the payroll employment report.
Right. Yeah, that's the information that goes
in. That's employment department.
So that should give you an idea how many employees these corporations are.
You're not broken down on our quarterlies, are we? When we file our quarterlies, it doesn't say we're a C corporation, S corporation, or anything.
Well, you have to make that determination early on in the year.
Right, but that's not employment doesn't have that. That's over revenue. Hence the problem.
It does have size, so it's reported by size.
It's about data sharing.
Right, but we're talking about tax code.
Yeah, but I'm saying it shouldn't be that.
It
depends on whether they share that data or not.
Okay. Right, exactly.
Go ahead. I'll leave it there then, I guess.
You don't want to jump into this quagmire.
Right.
Okay, where was I? Okay, so that was it for taxes. And here is a breakdown of kind of Oregon-only and multi-state corporations. And where we are now is about half, in terms of number of corporations, number of C corporations, half of them are Oregon-only and half of them are multi-state. So 15,000 Oregon-only, that means they're headquartered here and their market is only in Oregon. And the other 15 are headquartered somewhere and operate in multiple states. So of that 15,000, about 13,000 of them are headquartered outside of Oregon, and 2,000 of them are headquartered in Oregon, and they operate in multiple states. The incidence of the tax, though, is very different. Of the $500 million in tax, for about 400, so 80% of it comes from corporations, multi-state corporations that are headquartered out of state. And for the Oregon-only corporations, it's $50 million, so it's about 10% of the tax comes from the Oregon-only. So the number of corporations is about the same, but the vast majority of the revenue in the corporate system comes from the large multi-state headquartered elsewhere corporations. So that's the takeaway here, and then I won't go into the trend. You can mull that over at your convenience. So in the next page, this is a chart that is perennially on the chopping block for being in the document. It can be a little bit difficult to digest. But the idea here is getting at the size of the corporation by their income level. So, and the takeaway here is most of the corporations have a small amount of income, and it is a relatively few number of corporations that have most of the income and pay most of the tax. Just a couple of numbers. The top, well, no, that's, or in sales. So, but that's the takeaway here. It's, and that kind of makes sense because this is organized by income. If you have to have a lot of income to pay a lot of tax, or a lot of taxable income. Okay, so the next page, we start to break down corporations affected by the minimum tax and those affected by the rates. And a takeaway here is 2/3 of the C corporations pay the minimum tax. So 20,000 C corporations pay the minimum tax, and only 10,000 of them pay by the rates. And so that's broken out there. And those categories are the reason those particular sales categories are up there are those are the minimum tax categories. So that first column there, for Oregon sales, say for example, the $3 to $5 million, the minimum tax is $2,000. And even within the categories of, say, the minimum tax, of those 20,000 corporations that pay the minimum tax, the smallest ones, it's about 13,000 or 14,000 of them have less than $500,000 in Oregon sales. So it just drives home that point again that we have a lot of small C corporations. And even of those affected by rates, they're of those, well, the 9,000 up there, about half of them are, again, small corporations with less than $500,000 in Oregon sales. And then the bottom table is just broken down by industrial sector. A couple of takeaways here. For the top 100, if I take all of the Oregon corporations and sort them by Oregon sales, the top 100 corporations pay 40% of the, or have 40% of the sales, and the top 200 have 50% of the sales. So from a system perspective, C corporations, we're talking 30,000 corporations, but the top 200 of them have 50% of the sales. These are all just different ways of getting at that concept of to try and convey the concentration within the corporate excise tax.
Senator Bartrager.
So you said here just a little bit ago, when we were talking about pass-through money, dividends coming out of the corporations that's paid on the personal, you said that that number is about 10% of the personal income. Okay? So if we took 10% of the revenue from income tax and added it to all the corporation tax, wouldn't that number be how much tax is really paid by the corporations? Could you look at it that way?
Well, we're talking about different corporations probably. Now, so the Oregon personal income tax, 10% of that is business income pass-throughs and so forth. The dividends, however, that's going to be investments held by Oregonians. So I could have dividends. I could own stock in a corporation that has nothing to do with Oregon. They operate entirely on the East Coast. And the dividend income, but I live in Oregon. So when I file my personal income tax, I'll report the dividends that I get from those corporations. So it can get, again, unfortunately, pretty messy again in terms of trying to add those things up.
You see where I'm trying to get, though? You see, I'm trying to figure out what the real revenue income derived from corporations are to Oregon.
The way that we in the office talk about it is business tax, because corporation, well, that's not wrong. It's kind of a key term, and like a lot of the pass-through entities, LLCs and partnerships, aren't corporations. So one of the ways we try to drive that point, if I'm following you,
right,
we try to focus on business taxation. And I have worked with, I wasn't able to include it this time, but next time I'm hoping to include an actual bottom line tax, here the business taxes paid. The last couple of pages here get at returns and income. I need to take that a step further and really get at that business tax. So at a very back of the envelope sense of business taxes, we can take the corporation numbers, the 500 plus 10% of PIT, and that's business taxes, at least on the income side. Now, it doesn't account for property taxes or other things, but from an income tax side, that does get you at a concept of what businesses pay, corporations and non-corporations.
But dividends should somehow contribute to that, and I don't know how you'd calculate it either. I understand your frustration, yeah, but a certain amount of the dividends should count towards that.
That's another one of the footnotes. So, like, what I've just been talking about excluded the dividends because they're not tied to necessarily to businesses operating in Oregon. But that would be another conceptual piece of, well, some of it is. There are people living in Oregon who have dividends from Nike stock. Probably, I mean, it's pretty safe to say. And so a piece of that would be included. The question is,
how much? I love this committee. Got to think.
Two questions I have, Mr. Chair.
Senator Taylor.
No. Sorry.
Ladies first.
But isn't the building off of the dividend income, that's taxed at a completely different rate than regular earned income?
At the federal level,
right.
Yes.
And so, right. So that contribution to the pot at the federal level, but at the state level, isn't it at a different rate as well, or is it just go straight income?
At the state level, we just have one rate. It all goes into the same pot.
Okay.
The only income that only business income that is taxed at a different rate was one of the items on the list, the pass-through tax rates, which mm-hmm. we haven't really gotten into a lot of detail yet.
Okay.
that's not a corporation thing, but there is that exists here, and that's for pass-through entities who meet certain requirements. Mm-hmm. But the qualified dividend income that you're talking about is taxed at a lower rate than at the federal level. At the state level, it just goes into one pot.
Senator Boquist.
Thank you, Chair. Chris, in the report, does it include, even though what Senator Bertschinger is trying to get at in terms of what do they pay for taxes, though, does the report contain what the net income was for the S corporations? Because, of course, they file.
Oh, yes.
Right, so we have that. So you could actually do deductive reasoning backwards out of that, and hopefully when the computer system gets to some place, we can identify passive versus active income.
Yeah, there should be, conceptually, there should be enough bridges to piece it all together and come up with reasonable estimates.
Right.
Okay, and then the next chart, I'm almost finished here. The last one here is corporations paying more than the minimum tax. This is where the bulk of the revenue comes from, and it's these 10,000 folks. And it's another way of, it's a distribution by tax, so it just, again, highlights the small number of returns paying the lion's share of the tax. So for those corporations that paid at least $1 million in tax, that's about 1% of the corporations. It was 75 corporations. They paid about 45% of the tax in 2014. So that concentration has a direct impact on the policies that you will be debating and have been debated in the state for a number of years. So that's the bottom line takeaway, is it's concentrated. There are a lot of ways to look at it. So the last two charts I have on here get at this notion of business taxes. And the first one here are Oregon tax returns with business income. Now, I've mixed together personal income tax returns and the corporations. So we have sole proprietors, about 250,000 of those. These are Schedule C businesses that people file on their individual returns. I have a small consulting business. I file a Schedule C. Then I'm one of those 250,000 people. The farms there, the 30,000 farms, these are the sole proprietor farms. These are the Schedule F farms. These are not all of the farms in the state. It's a subset of the farms, and they're reported separately here because it's a Schedule F, and that's reported on the personal side, and we have that information. This is another area that has caused some confusion, and I've struggled with how to clearly convey all the farms, but the point is that it's not all of the farms in the state. It's just the Schedule F, the sole proprietor farms, if you will. Partnerships, one of the most common types of businesses these days are LLCs, limited liability corporations. They've been around for 25 years or so. These entities, they're referred to as creatures of the state, and that's because they don't exist in federal law. You can't go to the IRC and look up how does an LLC get taxed. It doesn't exist there. The status is granted by the states, and that's why they're called creatures of the state. So if I own an LLC, I still have to pay taxes. So I go to fill out my taxes, and I go to the federal site. I actually get to choose which structure I want to file as. I can file as a corporation. I can, in that case, I would show up as probably an S corporation, but I could also be a C corporation. I can even file as a Schedule C, and these are referred to as disregarded entities. The vast majority of LLCs, however, file as partnerships. That's generally how they operate. So a partnership and an LLC, they're technically different structures, and they're even substructures there, but they're largely the same thing. It's Christine and I want to get into a business. We just started an LLC. They're very easy to start, and they provide liability coverage, so those are very common these days. And a lot of the business growth has been in LLCs forming. So one of the common questions I get about this table is, where are the LLCs? Most of them are in the partnership number there. So we have about 60,000 partnerships, and we have about 60,000 S corporations. And then we have our 30,000 C corporations. So we have about 425 businesses. Now, a couple of cautions about that. The Schedule C, that's a total number of tax returns that file a Schedule C. I may run three businesses. I run a consulting business. I also run a garden business or a landscaping business, and then my wife also runs a separate business. We can file any number of C corp or Schedule C's, And say we file three Schedule C returns, they will show up. They kind of get collapsed together on the personal return. So that's just a footnote about the $250,000 there. One of the common questions we get are, how many businesses are there in the state? We often rely on this information as a starting point because it depends on how much detail you want. As it's, I sound like a broken record, it gets complicated fairly quickly, but for a number of businesses, the $400,000 is kind of what we go with, and it can be modified, or we can get more detail if needed, but usually that's the number. People want to know, do we have 40,000 or 40 million or 4 million? Again, it's the context for a lot of folks in terms of what's a reasonable number out there. And then the last chart I have here is the income reported on these forms. So in total, we have $17.7 billion of income. 3.6 of that are from the sole proprietors. Partnerships account for 2.2, S corporations 4, and then C corporations just under 8. So that gives a sense of the magnitude of where the income comes from. What I need to do is take this one step further to follow up on a lot of the questions and the comments from the committee today is, well, what's the actual tax incidence? And then that can even be taken a step further to include dividend income. But that's another step, and that's on the to-do list, if you will.
Okay.
So hopefully that wasn't too quick, and just some key terms, key concepts that we will revisit, and the more you hear about them, for better or worse, you'll start to understand them more.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, we have Kyle's on deck.
Kyle's on deck. What responsibility on number three? You have a clean pen?
Mazin,
just so you know, you're batting cleanup. You're batting cleanup. Baseball free.
Yeah.
Well, good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Kyle Easton, Legislative Revenue Office. And yeah, I'm here to talk about switching gears a little bit from the general fund sources of revenue to more the local government side. Property tax does in some way affect the general fund through the state school fund, and Dave Eck will get into this a little bit tomorrow to give some background on that. But for the most part, you can think of the property tax as it really is a local government funding source. And anytime you're talking about property tax, and I'll try to go through this rather briefly for you all today, because I know many of you are very well versed with it, you have to talk about the two voter initiatives that occurred during the 90s, Measures 5 and Measure 50. And those are the two primary foundational blocks of the property tax system. And an important aspect to keep in mind is they are in the Constitution. So when you're discussing overall property tax reform, it's primarily going to be a constitutional change. There's definitely things you can do on the statute level that are tweaks around the edges and everything, but if you're looking at full-on fundamental tax reform on the property tax side, it will have to go through the Constitution. So beginning with Measure 5, Measure 5 was passed in the early 90s or the mid-90s, and it really is about overall tax limits on the property tax side. So it set two tax limits in the Constitution, those related to local taxing districts that are in the education category, which would be K through 12, community colleges, and ESDs, or education service districts. And then everything else is lumped outside of that, which I'll just refer to as general government side. So the two taxing limits, they're based upon the real market value of the property. And on the education side, you have a limit of $5 per 1,000 of real market value. And then on the general government side is $10 per 1,000 of real market value. And so what occurs when you're computing the tax rates on a per property basis, if the taxes are imposed or extended at a rate higher than either of those constitutional limits, you get what we call compression. And that'll be reported generally as compression loss. So you have a max amount that you can impose. Anything above that doesn't actually get imposed because it would hit the constitutional limits, and we report that as compression loss. And you'll see that in a table later on. Measure 50, which was actually Measure 47 passed by the voters, couldn't quite be enacted the way that it was passed, so Measure 50 was referred to the voters from the legislature, made two fundamental changes on the property tax side. It shifted from taxes being levied based upon real market value to this idea of assessed value, and then also shifted from a levy-based property tax system to one that's rate-based. So taxing districts now have rates rather than levy, dollar levy amounts that they impose. Key points of the measure, of Measure 50 is when it moved from the real market value to the assessed value, it also put in place a 3% limit growth in maximum assessed value. So taxes are based on the assessed value of the property. That assessed value cannot grow more than 3% per year. So it gives a limit of a year-over-year growth in property taxes on a per property basis. Both of these limits really are based upon the property. And then also shifting from the levy base to the rate base, taxing districts were given rates based upon what they were levying at the time, and those are the rates on the permanent side of, that they are stuck with. Of course, you can impose local option levies through vote of the people and also bond levies as well. But the permanent rates are set as of the date when it went into effect. So that was in the late 90s based upon what was being imposed then. So districts that were imposing a lower amount of taxes at that time were given lower rates, and they have those rates today. Another key part of switching to the from the levy-based to the rate-based is how property tax exemptions work. When you're on a levy-based system, when you'd exempt a piece of property, it didn't matter too much on the local government side of things because they would impose the same amount of levy. So you would just raise taxes on all the other properties within the district. Under the rate-based system, instead of automatically raising taxes on all the other properties within the district, you actually do have a loss in revenue due to that exemption to the local governments. There is some shifting of the tax through the bond levies because those are still dollar-based levies, but you get about an 80% loss compared to that shift rate. So from a local government budgeting standpoint, the way exemptions work today is a little bit different than the way they worked prior to Measure 50. So it's a key thing to keep in mind there. So just getting into some of the tables and charts that we have in the basic facts document. One thing to keep in mind, and this is the case throughout the basic facts document, but especially in the case of the property tax system, is what you see or the what's being reported here is delayed a bit for reporting reasons when filing comes in and everything to that effect. But on the property tax side, the most recent data we have is for fiscal year 15-16. Which is actually based upon valuations done as of January 1st, 2015. So if you're looking at, say, real market value trends or assessed value trends, just keep in mind that you're almost looking at values 2 years ago. So if you're expecting a run-up or something to that effect, that doesn't show up necessarily right away. And this definitely becomes the case when, if you look at the data, when Oregon slips into a recession, or comes out of a recession. When we're slipping into recession, property tax may be a year or two behind, and then when Oregon's coming out of the recession, it may be a year or two before you see that show up in the property tax data. But the general trends, the chart I have up there right now is just showing the year-over-year change in the different types of property taxes imposed on the permanent side of things, local option, and then bond. Local option and bonds are levies, they usually last for, the local option levy lasts for 5 years, bonds can go a little bit longer, but they do require a vote of the people within the district. And fluctuations definitely on the bond side of thing, you can see some percentage changes in the chart there. There can be fluctuations just by a large bond expiring or a new bond coming on. So it can be difficult to really look at trends in the bond revenue. But you can see for the 15-16 year-over-year growth, overall imposed was at 4.8%. which is pretty much in line with the trend that we've seen since Measure 50 came into full effect, so in that late 90s period. The overall trend is about 4.9, 4.8.5, or something to that effect. So we're pretty much on trend in the last year. Let's see, moving on to the next table here, and it's a little bit small, it's definitely small up on the screen there. But the takeaway here on the chart I'm showing is to try to show the blue line you see there is the real market value growth, and then the red line is the assessed value growth. And you can definitely pick out pretty easily the growth trend during the late 2000s, where you had that run up in real market values on the housing sector, and then you can see the bubble burst more or less. We've come back down, and now we're beginning to see this growth in real market value again outstripping assessed value. and it widens that distinction between real market value and assessed value. And again, it's important to remember that property tax rates are imposed against the assessed value of a property, not the real market value. And I know this committee is well aware of some of the distinction where you can see two homes that have the same real market value but different assessed value. So two homes worth $300,000 on a real market side, one could have an assessed value, let's just say at real market value, so $300,000, the other one could be assessed at $200,000. Well, they're going to be paying taxes at about that same different proportion, even though the real market value of the homes are the same. Compression can come into effect there, certainly, but it does leave this distinction between properties that are valued the same and maybe have different growth trends since Measure 50 came into effect are paying different taxes today.
Senator Burchard?
So, Kyle, what you just said, when you gave the example of a $200,000 home and a $300,000 home, they're really the same. That's because one has been sold, and is that how they get the real market value? How is one being? Is that usually how it is?
Yeah, so, Senator, no. In California, does a reset at sale. Oregon does not do any reset at sale. So sales really don't affect a property's valuation other than it helps assessors understand maybe where the market's going. But they use sales data to value properties, even that ones that aren't selling. But really, it was at the time Measure 50 came into effect, assessed values were set at 90% of the real market value. And so it's the growth trend since then. So if the one property has stayed flat, hasn't been growing very much, where another one is located in maybe a different part of the city that's seen much higher growth levels, the real market value of the one property has just been surging. Its assessed value stuck at that 3% growth year over year. The other one is also growing at 3% year over year, but its real market value is not growing as fast either. So it's really the disparity comes from primarily for two properties that have both been existing for the last 20 years since Measure 50 came into effect.
It's precisely that problem that we're trying to fix with the ballot measure legislation.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
It's exactly that problem.
That's,
because
yeah.
It's really becoming a worse. It gets worse every year, not just in Portland, but in Salem, like the cities. And there's, you see the slides with the tail of two houses, and they're widely different. And you know, you get to a state where people are paying taxes that are, they're considering unfair. It's just inequitable. We have to address that. And not as a revenue raiser, but we have to fix that, and that's why we're looking at these ballot measures, Senator Boquist.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Kyle. Actually, more for the good senator to my left, benefit is the major problem. Is that if you take the map and put it out there, the largest concentration of this is really in the metro and specifically in Multnomah County. So trying to get a constitutional passage becomes very challenging. Correct?
Yes, Senator. There's definitely pockets. The Portland Metro is probably the largest, in terms of size, but also one of the largest contributors because it's seen a lot of that growth in the different areas. One of the areas that lends itself to very good examples is also the Bend area. Mm-hmm. I know we've had the Deschutes County Assessor has been here a number of times, and because when new property comes on the roll, so if you have an existing property, maybe you've had a vacant lot there for the last 15 years, when that new property comes on and is built, they use this average between real market value and assessed value to set that property, that new property's assessed value. So that's almost even the more extreme example where you have two properties side by side each other, they're neighbors, the valuation may be more or less the same of those two properties. But just because the one was built 15 years later than the other one, they could be taxed completely differently. And that's definitely some of the examples that have been brought to this committee by the assessors as well.
Of course, Mr. Chair, again, the challenge is if you take the houses out and put the people in, you got 80,000 in Bend and you have 1.5 million in Portland that we have to convince.
Okay.
Yes. Let's see. I guess skipping through a few charts here. The next one that I would just call your attention to is actually a new chart that was included this time in the basic facts. But I included it in there because I think it does a good job of illustrating sort of the level shift, if you will, that occurred after Measure 50. So it's after Measure 5 and 50 went into full effect, but starting in that late 90s. You can see what this chart is showing is this: the statewide average district imposed per $1,000 of real market value. And you can see that blue line is the overall tax imposed. The reddish orange line is the K through 12 ESD and community college. That's that education side of things. But you can see in the shifts from Measure 5 and 50, tax rates really did shift downward for the K through 12 for the education side of things and have stayed relatively flat since then. So the property tax system, there's a lot of stability built in from Measures 5 and 50 being in there. But you did have this overall shift down to a lower funding level. And that was reflective when Measure 5 went into effect. That was known. And it was in the Constitution that the state will pick up that loss in revenue on the education side of things. But it's one of the discussion points, and it's been a while since I've looked at the exact figures, but I believe it was prior to Measure 5, I think it was around 60, 70% of funding for K through 12 came from the property tax system. And we're now at the inverse of that, where the remaining came from the general fund. It's now about 60% that's coming on the general fund dollars and 40% that's the local government or the property tax is responsible for. So you can definitely see that change in funding source for the education system.
Question on the left, Mr. Chair.
Senator Taylor.
Do you have a sense, or maybe this is going to come up later, how much more revenue would generate if we were to do the reset, if we were able to make it so that everyone was taxed the same for the property? Well, how much more revenue would that be, do we know, statewide?
Yes, Senator Taylor, it's one of the, this committee's had that conversation a bit over the last year or two. I can definitely forward you some information that has been presented. We had a SJR 201, I believe was the last one that came up in the interim, where I did some simulations that show, based upon different policies, what the initial lift would be. Now, I applied it to past years where we had the full data set, and I mean, you're talking $1 billion, even more today, just by shifting immediately to real market value. Now, of course, one of the discussions in this committee was also having a homestead exemption be part of that and some other factors that could help do that. But you'd have that initial lift, and then you could, depending on how you wanted to work with the extra dollars there, you could make something revenue neutral, you could make something that doesn't lift or shifts to different type of properties, possibly reducing overall taxes for residential and shift them to other types of properties or something to that effect. But yeah, just to give you some scope, it is, and that was a couple fiscal years ago, so I think it's fair to say it's probably $1.2-1.3 billion at this time.
Kyle, I think we're at a stopping point here.
Yeah, Mr. Jones. Yeah.
Feel like, okay. Thank you for that overview, and to Chris, Christina, and Paul, and we'll pick up some of this again tomorrow, and have the revenue director here. So. Thank you all for your attention. And if you don't have a hard copy, or this basic facts is on OLIS, but it's a great, great reference document. Lots of times people ask me, "Is hey Mark, can you check with Paul to see if we increase the beer tax or if we did this?" You know, it's all in this book. So it's a great document to have as a reference.
Hey, Mr. Chair, we'll pinch hit with Mazen tomorrow. But
we'll pinch hit with Mazen. Yeah,
yep. I don't want base. To
Yes, thank you, sir. Okay, thank you all. We are adjourned.
Taylor, you're an auditor by trade.
Management.
Taylor, you're an auditor by trade.
Management.
Adjourned.